Wild Missions original podcast.
The Indonesian islands of Bali, Java, and Sumatra are part of the Sunda Islands, a group of islands in the Malay archipelago. These three islands were home to the Sunda tiger, one of two subspecies of tiger. In the 1950s, they were hunted to extinction on Bali, and again in Java in the 1970s, and so today, the Sunda tiger can only be found on the island of Sumatra. If you think we'd learnt our lesson by now, we haven't, because there are thought to be less than 400 of these tigers left in Sumatra, so the time for action is now. Luckily, there are already inspiring organisations such as the International Tiger Project working in Indonesia to secure the long-term survival of the tiger. So what can we do to help them? I'm Andy Varvel, and this is Cats of the Wild, Episode 20, Sumatra's Last Tigers.
Hi, I'm Leif Cox, and I'm the founder of the International Tiger Project.
Leif is actually a world-renowned orangutan expert, and he first started the Orangutan Project in 1998.
I've been working with exotic animals, including tigers, for maybe 30 years. But in particular, you know, I've been working with orangutans. And we call that an umbrella species, which case, you know, if you save the orangutans, you'll save the rainforest, the biodiversity needs to come underneath it. And what we discovered that there was a couple of species slipping out from outside the umbrella protection, which needed specific actions to ensure their survival. And those two were elephants and tigers. And that's why we started the International Elephant Project and the International Tiger Project, to make sure all the living beings and all the biodiversity was included under a holistic plan to save all the species from extinction.
Sumatra's forests are home to the critically endangered Sumatran orangutan, rhinoceros, and elephant. And of course, the Sunda tiger, more commonly known as the Sumatran tiger.
The Sumatran tiger is the most critically endangered of all tigers, and it's also the smallest of all living tigers. Now, there's a thing called islandification, which means basically the smaller the island, the smaller the mammal. And that holds true with tigers. So we've already seen the extinction of the Bali tiger on the island of Bali, and we've seen the extinction of the Javan tiger on the Javanese island. The last two actually were shot in the Ranganan Zoo in Jakarta in 1943, just prior to the invasion of the Japanese. And so the last tiger in Indonesia, which lives on the island Sumatra, is a Sumatran tiger, which is critically endangered. So it's the next one to fall off the perch in basically a cascading dominoes effect of extinction on larger and larger islands. And so we've only really got the next 10 years to turn this around and bring the Sumatran tiger back from extinction.
Sumatran tigers continue to be the target of poachers in the illegal wildlife trade. Just recently, Indonesian officials confiscated several tiger skins from a man in Sumatra believed to be connected to a larger ring of wildlife traffickers. No one wants a future where you can only see a Sumatran tiger at a zoo, and even these captive breeding programs by zoos are unlikely to ever save the tiger from extinction in the wild.
You can't save them in captivity. I used to do the small population genetics for those sorts of species in captive zoos. So zoos can't save themselves. You know, if let's explain megafauna, these aren't saving tigers or elephants or orangutans. Although there's actually more tigers in America in backyards than there are in Sumatra, they are all inbred and they're all hybrids and have genetic problems. And so they have a conservation outcome. They just play things for the rich and the crazy. So it may be difficult to save them in the wild, but it's going to be impossible to save them in captivity. And once we lose a habitat, very hard to get it back. So first of all, we've got to save the habitat. and it's going to be enough for tigers to roam and have enough prey species. We've got to work out human conflict mitigation issues with local communities. And thirdly, we're dealing with criminal syndicates that move into the areas, particularly the poaching for the Chinese medicine trade and these sorts of things. So that was kind of almost the bit that was missing for us when we're trying to conserve the tiger. We're saving the habitat, we're working with local communities, but that wasn't stopping criminals coming in specifically to, you know, take out remaining population tigers for short-term profit. Because, you know, drug smugglers and weapons smugglers and wildlife traffickers, all the same people. So they have those kind of networks that to transport the tigers out.
The biggest threat, however, to the Sumatran tiger is habitat loss. And Sumatra has already lost 50% of its tropical rainforest in just 35 years. This continuing reduction in forest places extreme pressure on the locals and the wildlife that are left.
The indigenous communities and the wildlife, such as tigers, are now fighting over the remaining forests to survive, basically killing each other to try to survive in the scraps which have been left by the greedy, large multinationals. And so our job is to try to secure the right type, shape, and size of ecosystems where we can have significant populations of tigers to survive, and then work with local communities for a win-win solution where this large, dangerous predator and humans can coexist in a way into the future. But unfortunately, it's the same with elephants. There is no real one habitat left where there's going to be a sustainable population tiger. That's just fantasy land now. And so we've got these tigers, like subpopulations of tiger, genetically isolated and will basically breed to extinction. So as well as conserving these sanctuaries of wildlife, about 200,000 hectares, can have a half decent size population of Sumatra tigers. In the long run, we still have to remove, let's say, problem tigers, especially the males, and translocate them from one population to another to manage the Sumatran tiger until hopefully one time in the future that a significant part of the planet will be rewilded and part of our necessary efforts to save the planet, and tigers can help form that biodiversity in the future.
Rainforests like those in Sumatra are typically carbon sinks, absorbing up to a quarter of all global fossil fuel emissions since 1960. But what can happen is that through continual deforestation, forests can succumb to the effects of dangerous climate feedback loops. And this can turn a forest from a carbon sink into a major source of carbon emissions.
It's this really nasty feedback loop. I mean, you know, rainforest destruction is contributing significantly to climate change. But then with climate change, we're getting increasing El Nino years.
El Nino.
El Nino.
El Nino.
El Nino.
El Nino.
A naturally occurring climate pattern with warmer than usual waters in parts of the Pacific Ocean.
Increasing droughts.
Water levels there have dropped 15 meters since last year, caused by the worst drought Brazil has seen in more than 90 years.
Which then increases fire.
Hotspots are still blazing in parts of Sumatra and Kalimantan. Now, over the last few days, the number of hotspots have been fluctuating between 500 to less than 2,000 over large swathes of land.
Reduces flowering and food production, which means basically it's reducing the amount of rain, and rainforests produce rain, but also needs rain. And so the remaining rainforests then become unsustainable. It starts falling apart. It can't support the biodiversity. It starts releasing carbon. It starts collapsing on itself. And then that causes more global warming, which then comes back and feeds that same system. And that's why we have these kind of feedback loops and these tipping points. The madness is we've got the next 10 years to do this. Otherwise, you know, we have this cascade of collapse of the planet. So one of the great things we're doing when we say the same as Sumatra tiger, it's just a win-win solution for everybody. You know, if you understand the system, it's not about the environment versus the economy or wildlife versus people. It's about, gee, you know, we've got a few greedy people who are destroying the planet. and even their children are going to be suffering. Or we could just make some sensible decisions now and turn this around. So that's a challenge, and that's a challenge for, you know, the conferences with all the politicians, is to get them to understand we don't have a choice.
The primary driver for rainforest deforestation in Sumatra is the conversion of forest to monoculture plantations such as oil palm and rubber, often at the hands of large multinational corporations. There's now four times the amount of land in Sumatra for oil palms than there is habitat for species like the Sumatran tiger and orangutan. You see, palm oil is the second most widely produced edible oil, and it's found in around 50% of all packaged foods. Even if you look for palm oil on the label of a product, you might not find it, as it's often named vegetable oil or something else. Even toothpaste, ice cream, detergent, and lipstick is likely to contain palm oil. So, as a consumer, what can we do to ensure that we are making a positive impact on Sumatra's forests?
The trouble with anti-palm oil campaigns doesn't really address the issue. The issue is big multinationals and big corporations influence governments to give them rainforests where they make a lot of money knocking the trees down, and they put whatever unsustainable monoculture makes them the quickest profit as possible and destroys the land, and they walk away. Now, palm oil is an extremely good product for that. But there's many other products. There's pulp paper, there's sugar palm, you know, there's rubber and several other examples, not to mention the coal under the ground. So you can go spend all your life getting palm oil banned or sustainable, if that, well, of course, that doesn't exist. No monoculture is sustainable. But then you look back and go, well, now I'm really satisfied all the palm oil is sustainable, but now all the rainforest is acacia trees for pulp paper. I mean, you know, it's fine. There's nothing wrong with trying to reform an industry and making the unsustainable palm oil product less destructive. And a lot of good people in the palm oil campaigns do that, and I applaud that. But that's very different from saving a rainforest. That's a different set of outcomes. And ultimately, to save a planet and save the tides, we've got to save the rainforest. And so myself or yourself going in and becoming palm oil free, or checking at, you know, some label which tells you it's sustainable, you know, it doesn't do anything. Even if we all did it, it's not going to make a change. And as us as individuals, it's even less so. And so we have to get together and work on this together intelligently and, yeah, using science and understanding the situation. Otherwise, we're pretty much lost.
This idea of coming together to make change is something Leif is pretty passionate about. He calls it collectivizing and considers it the only hope we have against powerful governments and multinationals destroying rainforests around the world.
So by collectivizing, it can make a significant difference. I have to say, we've been sold this lie over many years that our individual actions can make meaningful change. Our individual actions are good for our moral activity, but those who know how to collectivize destroy the planet. We've got to collectivize in our communities and non-government organizations and make this significant change, and we have to do it now. And that's why one of the significant things International Tiger Project does, it provides opportunity for people who don't have the skills and the ability all the time to be able to collectivize in a way which is going to make a meaningful outcome while our politicians dither around the edges of real action.
Leif argues that most people in developed nations are either time rich or money rich, and that in itself is a huge privilege. So whether you're a student in Melbourne, a trader in New York, or a teacher in Singapore, there's opportunities for all of us to make a difference.
People are either often money rich and time poor. You know, I'm a rich businessman, I'm making a lot of money, I'm stressed out. Look, here's some money. Go save the planet, you guys. Okay, I'll do that for you, and I'll report back of what we've done with your money. A lot of other people, time rich, but money poor, and they can volunteer. They can help out with events, run stalls, and contribute their time, which basically means that very few people are not in either one of those categories, you know, at least in developed nations. And so we can all contribute. But that leads on to the point is the majority of people outside of developed nations aren't in that situation. They have no power, they have no time, they have no money, you know? And so we're living in the most important period in human history, the most important 10 years of human history, which is going to determine the outcome of the species and our civilization surviving. So that's a great responsibility. But we, for example, in developed countries, we have a more striking responsibility. 90% of the world population, no matter what they do, say, or feel, living some dictatorship in some poor country trying to farm and feed your children, they can't do a thing. Yeah, they're just trying to survive, you know, and have no power at all. And we enrich developed democracies. It's only us that has the capacity to make meaningful change. And hell, you know, and if we drop that ball of responsibility in the next 10 years, we would be, you know, the subset of the basically doomed human civilization. We've got to take this opportunity now and understand the privileged position that we are in the world. And with that privilege becomes that responsibility to pull our fingers out in the next 10 years and make a real significant change.
Now, that message isn't supposed to be one that's depressing or hopeless. For me, it's a message of hope, of responsibility, and of action. So whether it's the forest of Sumatra for tigers and orangutans or the Mongolian steppe for the Manul, we're not powerless, we're actually powerful, and it's up to us to contribute to make change. Luckily though, there's organisations like the International Tiger Project that are working on the ground in Indonesia to protect the Sumatran tiger from extinction.
First of all, we work with a lot of wonderful Indonesian partners, both individuals, foundations and companies, and that's the basis for which we operate through. And so that may be, for example, supporting existing government structures, like supporting national parks and the security and development national parks, supporting local foundations, working with the indigenous community to save the forest and protect ecosystems. And thirdly is through the companies that we've helped fund, is actually lease the land from the government and actually restore the hydrology and the environment back to become a sustainable ecosystem.
Sustainable doesn't just mean sustainable for the environment, but it's for the local people as well. The palm oil industry employs over 8.4 million Indonesians. So if there is any hope in restoring the forest in Sumatra, they need to be able to sustainably support the local people that live there.
So the business model at the moment is to destroy the rainforest, make a lot of money from it, plant some agriculture, let's say palm oil, and in 6 years' time it leaves a barren desert wasteland after destroying all the environment around it. Win-win, you know, for the big rich people, they go retire in Australia in the multi-million dollar home. Hey, there's poor people, man, it sucks for them, you know. So what we want to do, and it's not wildlife versus people, but the main thing is you can make more money per hectare out of an intact rainforest ecosystem because it all works. And we can develop agricultural systems under the rainforest canopy with the local communities, such as vanilla, dragon blood, which is a dye which is worth more per weight than gold. Then you've got jungle rubber, rattan, shade cocoa, shade coffee. And so you have this diverse kind of agricultural system under the rainforest canopy. And so our plan is not only to save these ecosystems of being functioning environmentally, but actually sustainably economically. So the local community have a sustainable ongoing income where they become rich and prosperous while maintaining and protecting the rainforest itself, which supports the environmentally friendly agricultural systems underneath it. So when I die, the plan is that, you know, not to leave something that just implodes or is unsustainable, but to leave these ecosystems for future generations that will have life, both economically and environmentally. I just give you one example where they found themselves in. There's two communities, the Talak Malak community, which is slash and burn agriculture. They knock down a bit of rainforest, burn it, they put the fertility in the soil, plant it for 3 years, crops start failing, they move on to the next bit. But by the time they come around, the forest has regenerated, the soil has been rejuvenated, you know? And this has worked sustainably for centuries. And then we have the Arang Rimba community, which are hunter-gatherers, which go through the forest hunting and gathering. There's two ethnic groups. Now, the big multinationals have taken all their land, because their land rights haven't been recognized. Suddenly, the slash and burn agriculture and hunter-gathering is no longer sustainable, not because they've changed anything, is their land has been stolen from them. And so we as conservationists trying to save the tigers, the orangutans, and the elephants, are stuck in this remaining forest, you know, that's left, and everyone's fighting over the remaining forest. And it, as it's slowly being destroyed by the poor people trying to maintain their old agricultural hunting gathering, which is no longer sustainable, not by their fault. And so what we need to do is support them through that development process to come out the other side, not only sustainable, but richer and more affluent than they ever were in the past. And so that's why we not only need money to legally save the forest, protect it, restore it, and reforest it in some cases, but we need the money so we can work with the local communities to develop the agricultural systems. But the great thing is, if we can pull this off within the 10-year time span, we won't have to put any more money in it. The communities will be rich and prosperous. The land will be protected. And that biodiversity arcs, which we'll be leaving behind, will have the perfect resource for the rewilding of the planet.
So, the clock is ticking. We've got less than 10 years. Is this even possible?
Well, look, we can turn this around. Is 400 to 300 Sumatran tiger the sustainable population? Nah, no way. Right, you need probably 1,000, 2,000 to be a sustainable population. But what I do know from, you know, my old job as a small population biologist is even though the population is relatively small, because it's been destroyed very quickly, those individuals within the population are highly genetically diverse. So if we can stop the destruction of the population, allow them to breed up quickly, very little genetic loss will happen, and then you can bring it back up. And that's a wonderful thing. Let's say with elephants and orangutans and very slow reproducing species, they recover extremely slowly. The great thing about tigers is you don't have to worry about reintroduction projects or that sort of stuff. Basically, if you can protect the ecosystem and the few tigers who are surviving, in 5-6 years, they're bred up and expanded out, you know, and re-establish the numbers, which will allow ongoing relative genetic stability. And then in the medium term, as I mentioned earlier on, that we still have to resort to transferring tigers between populations if we're going to get them through the extinction crisis. Hi, I'm Leif Cox, the founder of the International Tiger Project. If you're inspired to help the tiger and all the benefits for every living being that comes from this help, please visit International Tiger Project and help contribute to a meaningful way of making that outcome.
Thanks so much to Leif for his time, as well as Mark Clifford from Orange Orchard PR for arranging the interview. All of the links to the International Tiger Project are at wildmissions.com/Cats of the Wild. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Cats of the Wild Podcast and subscribe and review on Apple Podcasts. Cats of the Wild is created by me, Andy Varvel. Theme music is by Score Squad. Other music and sound effects from Envato.